All right. So, last time we had just finished talking about a bunch of drugs, and we're about to get to the big one, steroids. So let's recap ever so quickly the different drugs. So the very first drugs we had were calcineurin inhibitors. Calcineurin is the precursor to interleukin-2. Interleukin-2 is the cytokine that is responsible for proliferation of T cells.
I don't think we got that far. We left on
Yeah, I know, but we were doing drugs.
Up to me. We drew our hand.
Yeah, the hand.
What drug? Oh, Hydra. Okay.
Yeah, we did all the drugs. This is recap. Except for steroids. So, how about if I just tell you the drug name, and then you'll say, oh yes, we did that.
Okay.
So, for calcineurin inhibitors, there are two of them. The first one is cyclosporin, and the second one is tacrolimus. Do you see what I'm up against now?
I got you.
Yep. So, their main use for these drugs is transplant, but they are used for some other things like Crohn's disease. You can use them for rheumatoid arthritis, etc. But the bottom line is they're immunosuppressants. They work by decreasing the number of T cells, and the number one adverse effect is going to be risk for infection. And in terms of etiology, if a patient has an infection while on one of these drugs, what would we consider that? What kind of etiology would that be? You're on an immunosuppressant, and then you get an infection. Iatrogenic. So, all right. Then the next class of drugs was cytotoxic drugs. These are drugs that target all fast-growing cells. So, in addition to T cells and B cells and neutrophils, it's also going to affect skin cells and other epithelial cells. It can also affect liver cells because liver regenerates fairly quickly. So the three drugs that we mentioned there, azathioprine, that's the one you'll need to know for your test, and then two others that are very commonly seen in practice are captopurine and methotrexate. Again, the number one adverse effect is going to be infection, and then you can also have skin side effects, hair loss side effects because hair follicles are one of the fast-growing cells. You can have sores in the mouth. And those are all additional adverse effects. Red blood cells. If it targets red blood cells, you'll have lower red blood cell count. And the fancy schmancy name for that is anemia. What's the fancy schmancy name for low white blood cell count? Leukopenia. And you could also have lower platelet counts, thrombocytopenia. All right, the third class that we did last time was biologics. Now, biologics is more of an approach than a true class of drug. So it's an antibody that is targeted against a single particular protein or substance. So most of the biologics that we have are targeted against TNF-alpha, so the tumor necrosis factor. And by targeting that, you lower the amount of TNF, which in turn is going to reduce the amount of inflammation present in the body. Same idea, if you're targeting an inflammatory mediator, you're going to lower the amount of inflammation. That puts your patient at risk for infection and a whole bunch of other stuff. And the drug name that we had said was like adumablab, which is Humira. If you watch TV at all, your chances are you'll see lots of commercials for Humira and other drugs that end in MAB. So remember that MAB stands for monoclonal antibody. And the reason that it's monoclonal is that the drug is full of antibodies that are exactly the same. So mono, one, clone. They're cloned off of one thing. So there's a number of different monoclonal antibody drugs that target various things, but in terms of inflammation, the number one thing they target most often is going to be TNF-alpha. Alright, then we talked about antihistamines, first generation and second generation. What is the big difference between the two generations?
The first gen has older and it has more adverse effects.
First gen has more adverse effects. What are the two major types of adverse effects that they have? Drowsiness and anticholinergic effects. So, if you're having a hard time staying up and you want to sleep, maybe you have a cold, which would be more appropriate, a first or a second generation? A first generation. Now, during a cold, is there lots of histamine being produced? So if you want to dry up your nose that's running, would you prefer a first generation or a second generation? A first generation, because you want those anticholinergic side effects to dry you up. Now, if what you have is just a regular old allergic reaction, what would be better to take typically? A second generation, because it will not be drowsy and it will not give you all those other anticholinergic effects. On an elderly patient, what would be better?
Second.
A second, because anticholinergic effects in elderly can mimic Alzheimer's disease. All right, so as far as drug names, we gave you the big one is diphenhydramine, which is also known as Benadryl. Very, very commonly used in the hospital IV. When we have a patient who's going to be receiving some sort of drug that has a high risk of allergic reaction, or if we know they're already allergic to something, but there's no other choice, we have to give it to them anyway. So sometimes with like an imaging test, they're allergic to dye, you know, the IV contrast, and so we know that they're going to have an allergic reaction. We'll pre-dose them with Benadryl first, then give them whatever it is they're allergic to. We also mentioned hydroxyzine, mostly because of its active metabolite, which is a second generation, cetirizine, Zyrtec. And then we also mentioned doxylamine, which is the active antihistamine in NyQuil. But for your test, the only one you need to know is diphenhydramine. Then the second generation, we had fexofenadine, Allegra, loratadine, Claritin, desloratadine, which is Clarinex, and it's the active metabolite of loratadine. So it works much faster than Claritin. Claritin takes about 3 hours to start working because your liver has to chop it up into desloratadine. So by giving desloratadine as the drug itself, it speeds it up and works a little bit better. You also don't need quite as high a dose because it's not being lost in the liver. And then the last one is cetirizine, which is Zyrtec. We mentioned where that comes from. And then we have the left versus the right hand of Zyrtec, which is levocetirizine, also known as Zizol. I do not know who comes up with these names. But one size, Zizol. That was terrible. Let's pretend like that didn't happen. All right, so at this moment, we're going to pick up with another drug class, and this is our last drug class for anti-inflammatories. How do you feel about that?
Good.
No, Dr. Heyman, we want more. Okay, so this one is steroids. Now, when you think of the word steroid, what do you think of? Arnold Schwarzenegger. People with no necks. Now, that type of steroid is known as anabolic steroid and is drugs that stimulate testosterone receptors. Now, technically the word steroid means any substance that contains sterol in it, which, if you remember way, way back to your chemistry class, is just a structure of molecule. So, you're probably most familiar with the term sterol in the term cholesterol. Cholesterol. Now, the word choly comes from bile. Cholera is another name for bile. So, the bile duct is in your... bile is produced in your liver, secreted into the bile duct, stored in the gallbladder. Gall is yet another name for bile. Oh, so many names. So bile, cholera, and gall are all the same thing, stored in the little gallbladder, and then when you eat a meal, and it squirts out. So the cholesterol that's being stored there, some of it is going to be secreted, but some of it helps to emulsify fats so that you can absorb them. So it got its name because we first found this sterol compound in the bile. That is just trivia. You don't need to know that for your test. But hey, you heard it. Can't erase it now. Now, some other famous sterols that you might want to know about. Estrogen. We already mentioned testosterone. But the one that we're talking about today is corticosteroid. Now, what does cortico imply? Where would it come from? A cortex? How many cortexes are you aware of in the body? Okay, the adrenal cortex, and what else? Prefrontal cortex. So, it's either coming from your brain or it's coming from your adrenal glands. Which one do you think it is? The adrenal glands. All right. Now, time to see how much you paid attention in A&P2. What are the five hormones secreted by the adrenal gland? We should argue epi and norepi, but that's from the medulla, not the cortex. Three left from the cortex. That's pituitary. Renin is secreted by the renal kidneys. Aldosterone. Cortisol. And then sex hormones. If you're a man, then it's going to be estrogen. And if you're a woman, then it'll be testosterone. So your adrenal gland will produce the opposite of whatever you are. Everyone needs a little bit of both. And so your primary sex organs, ovaries for women, testicles for men, that is what produces your estrogen for women, testosterone for men. And then your adrenal gland will produce the opposite in much smaller amounts. Does that make sense? So cortisol is actually what corticosteroids do. They activate cortisol receptors. Now, if you remember what cortisol does, one of the things it does is it raises blood sugar. So as a result, sometimes corticosteroids are called glucocorticoids. So, the thing from the cortex that affects glucose. So you'll hear those terms used interchangeably, glucocorticoids and corticosteroids. They're the same thing. And they're drugs that activate what receptor?
Cortisol.
Okay, so let's just mention the drug names first, so that way we can talk about them as we go along. So they are ranked by potency. Now, what does the word potency mean?
How much
dose it takes to reach a certain level of efficacy. So the drugs that are more potent, you don't need as high a dose to get as strong an effect. So there's six drugs that we're going to learn at this time. And the first one is hydrocortisone. Now this is essentially artificial cortisol. And it's basically a one-to-one relationship. So it's one times as strong as cortisol. Basically the same. Then, if we modify the hydrocortisone, take the hydro off, you end up with cortisone. Now the thing about cortisone is that it can be given differently. It can be given PO, whereas hydrocortisone cannot be absorbed PO. It's also a one-to-one relationship. Next we have prednisone and methyl prednisolone. Prednisolone. All right, so methylprednisolone and prednisone are both approximately 4 to 5 times as potent as cortisol. In the hospital, methylprednisolone is going to be the one that you see the most often. It comes in two forms, oral and injection. The injectable version, well, the brand name for both of them is Medrol, but for the injectable version, it's called Solu-Medrol. Tell me what the Solu means. Solution? That's right. Now, there's a funny thing about Solu-Medrol. Once you put the drug into the water, or the saline, whatever you use to mix it with, it degrades fairly quickly and stops being effective. So, you're not going to get a vial of liquid. What are you going to get? A vial of powder that you have to, what's called, reconstitute. Now, the cool thing with our little technology is they have this little device that looks kind of like two vials on top of each other. So there's liquid in the top one and there's powder in the bottom one. And so what you do is you squeeze the two halves together, and there's a little stopper in the middle here that gets pushed down. And when that happens, the water mixes with the drug and you end up with the solution that you draw up. So you, as the nurse, are going to prepare this right before you actually inject it into the patient. Does that make sense? So, in the hospital, methylprednisolone is by far the most common one, general use and steroid. Prednisone is the most common oral one that you're going to see outpatient. So, in the community, people take prednisone more often, and in the hospital, they're going to take methylprednisolone more often.
So, methylprednisolone is the one with the powder.
Yeah. So, methylprednisolone is the one that you have to reconstitute so you can inject it. And the brand name would be Solumedrol. Alright, then we have two more to go. And these are 20 to 30 times stronger, or more potent, I should say, than cortisol. And the first one is dexamethasone. And then the last one is same thing, and it's called beta-methasone. Now, what is this whole unit been on? What's the major topic of the unit? No, that's the drug we're talking about. The whole unit we've been talking about for like the last like 3 hours. Inflammation. So these drugs do what? Reduce inflammation. So the purpose of these is to reduce inflammation. Dexamethasone is kind of like a general purpose, really strong one. Most often you're going to see it used in cancer patients, but sometimes you'll see it used in other settings as well. Betamethasone, the main place you're going to see it in the hospital is labor and delivery. And one of the functions of cortisol, now cortisol is considered a stress hormone, if you recall way back from ANP2, so when you have large amounts of stress, you get large amounts of cortisol being released. Now, in a little fetus's life, what do you think is the most stressful thing that happens to that little guy before he's born?
Like when the water breaks.
Being squeezed through a little birth canal? Have you seen a little baby after it's born that way? What does its head look like? Cone head, right? Do you think that's a little stressful?
Yeah.
And what about this process, like where the cervix is like grows, and as that happens, there's these contractions, and the baby's like, it's a little stressful, right? So during the birthing process, large amounts of cortisol are going to be released, maturing that little guy's lungs, because up until now he's been breathing water. Just like in the movie The Abyss. Before your time, don't worry about it. So, at this point though, the little guy's gotta grow lungs that finally work and breathe air. Up until this point, his lungs have not matured because he hasn't had a need to have them inflated with air. Now he's gotta survive outside the mother's womb, gotta take that first breath. So, in order to do that, we have to mature the lung. The final maturation of the lung is driven by cortisol. So, if you have a premature child, you know, the premature labor, where the woman's going to deliver the baby earlier than expected, one of the things you want to do is you want to mature that little guy's lungs, or girl's lungs, before they are delivered. And the way we do that is we administer betamethasone to who? To the mother. Did you do this before the kid is born? Not afterwards. It's too late after that. So, putting all the drugs we've learned together about premature labor, if we want to stop the premature labor from happening, what drug, or try to stop it anyway, what drug do we use? What drug? Terbutaline. Well, what if it doesn't work? Now the kid's going to be born. We want to make sure he's got a mature lung, so what do? Give betamethasone. To whom? To the mother. So that's the major place you're going to see betamethasone. Now, you will see both betamethasone and dexamethasone used outpatient as topical preparations, ointments and creams. But inside the hospital, inpatient, cancer is probably the number one place you're going to see dexa, and then labor and delivery for beta. Most of the rest of the time, what you're going to be seeing is oral prednisone and IV methylprednisolone. There is a specific time frame, and because this is not a labor and delivery class, we don't care. You can look it up on your own. I'm sure it's in the book. Well, I mean, I don't care. Maybe you care. But I've seen more than enough deliveries in my lifetime. I'm kind of done with that phase of my life now. But anyway, so these are the six drugs that you're going to need to know for the tests. We'll be learning a few more as we go along. For example, there's inhaled steroids we use for inflammatory lung diseases, and we'll learn those when we do respiratory. But for now, what we need to know is these six. And we need to know how strong each one is, and some general things about each one, which we just talked about. Now, hydrocortisone, I've got to mention this before we end. Hydrocortisone is available over the counter. And that means it's the number one most seen or most used in the whole world, or in the United States anyway. But in terms of oral, it's prednisone. So don't get that mixed up on the test. The most common, generally speaking, is hydrocortisone because you can get over the counter, but it's topical. Creams, ointments, suppositories.
Okay.
So
the most common is PO.
The most common PO is going to be prednisone. All right, so now let's talk about what the drug does and some adverse effects from the drug. So the number one thing that we want the drug to do is going to be what? Reduce inflammation. So you're going to need much, much higher doses than normal. There is a disease we'll learn about in Pathopharm 2 where a person doesn't have enough cortisol production. And you give cortisone PO for that. But that's not the subject of now. The subject of now is using these drugs to treat inflammation. So we're using much higher doses than physiological doses. So at physiological doses, cortisol does things like it raises glucose levels, it raises sodium levels, and it raises blood pressure by raising sodium levels. It's going to affect protein metabolism and fat metabolism. It increases hunger. And deals with a couple other electrolytes, the most important of which is calcium. All right, so these are the big ones. Now, in addition to all of that, it also deals with inflammation. Now, what are we targeting in this unit? We're targeting inflammation. So everything else is a potential adverse effect. Does that make sense? So this is what we want, reduce inflammation. And this is what we're going to get in addition. Now, some of these are important short term. Sometimes you only take these drugs for a day or a week. But sometimes you take these drugs for life. And so some of these adverse effects are going to be more important for acute, and some are going to be more important for chronic. Does that make sense? So, adverse effect number one, what happens when your blood sugar goes up? Okay, it mimics diabetes. So it can actually be a cause of diabetes. What's the fancy name for blood sugar high? Hyperglycemia. Elevated sodium. So we call that hypernatremia. But what's important is that it will lead to elevated blood pressure. So high blood pressure. If you've got a patient who's already got high blood pressure, could that be a problem? Yeah, it can be a problem. These things are relatively short acting, so they'll be a concern from the moment the patient takes the drug. Potentially, anyway. Protein metabolism. The main thing it does is it prevents the, or not say prevents, reduces protein anabolic pathways, which promotes protein catabolism. What does catabolism mean? Well, if you're a bodybuilder, what effect do you want? Anabolic or catabolic? Anabolic, big, grow. Catabolic, break down. So if we're breaking down proteins, that's going to be protein catabolism. So three really important things for protein catabolism. First one is muscle wasting. Patients who are on chronic steroids tend to have lower muscle mass.
Would that be like muscle atrophy or no?
Yeah, it gets atrophy and, smaller muscles. So they tend to have muscle wasting. Second one is, what's the protein in your skin called that provides strength? Keratin? No, that provides the waterproofing. And there's another one that produces the elastic effect. What's that one called? Elastin. That was easy. And the third one is sometimes injected into people's lips. Collagen. So the decreased collagen in the skin leads to weaker skin. So patients who have weaker skin are more likely to have skin tears or other wounds. It can get to the point where the skin is so fragile that we call it tissue paper skin because it tears as easily as tissue paper. Now, that's really, really important as nurses because if you're taking a patient and you're moving them, you go into a patient's room and they're like all slumped in bed. Oh, I got to pull you back up in bed. You can't slide them. You've got to lift and... Does that make sense? So you have to be very, very careful. Even just taking the blood pressure, you can break their skin if you're not careful. So that is tissue paper skin from loss of collagen. And then the third one is also a collagen issue, and then combined with the decreased inflammation, which is decreased wound healing. So the patients will not be able to heal as well. We haven't covered wound healing just yet, but I'll give you a little quick preview. You have to create a scar tissue. And the scar tissue is a protein matrix formed of collagen. Same stuff that provides the strength in your skin is what provides scar tissue. If you can't make that scar tissue in the first place, it's much, much harder to heal. And then on top of that, remember, inflammation is one of its purposes is to prepare the body for repair. And if you can't do that as well because you're suppressing it, decreased wound healing is the result. So all of these three things are a result of protein catabolism. Now, fat metabolism problems. There tends to be a redistribution of fat. So these are sometimes called lipid dystrophies. Dys meaning bad or wrong. And trophy meaning shape. So the three places it's going to tend to redistribute. First one is the back of the neck. This is called buffalo hump. I didn't make it up. So there's a fat pad right here at the base of the neck. The next one is to the face. And this is called moon face. So people who have this effect, they'll have these like very round faces. If you just Google moon face, or Siri Moonface, you'll see pictures of exactly. Once you see it, you're like, oh, steroid person, you're on steroids. You know, it's very noticeable, that kind of appearance. And then the third one is central adiposity, which is a fancy way of saying you get redistribution to your midsection. Now, women, because of estrogen, tend to store fat where? Hips and buttocks. But when you're under the influence of elevated levels of cortisol or cortisol-type drugs, you end up having it in the belly. Now, when you combine some essential adiposity with muscle wasting, you have a classic appearance known as toothpicks on a lemon. Yeah, I had a friend who had a lung transplant, and to prevent rejection, she had been on steroids for 15 years. And she went to this new doctor, and he's like, oh, you're on steroids, you've got toothpick on a lemon.
Oh my God.
I think he was actually telling the medical students that. Look, everybody, she has toothpicks on a lemon. So that is the three things that tend to happen. So to prevent these things from happening, one of the things you want to do is make sure your patient's eating adequate protein. And the second thing you want to do is promote muscle synthesis by having them exercise. And then the third thing we want to do is we want to limit the overall calories, which can be difficult because what does cortisol do? It promotes hunger. And it also makes food taste better. I had a boss once who had been on steroids for some reason or other, and she's like, we would go out to eat, and it'd be like the most ordinary hamburger in the whole world. We're like, have you ever tasted a hamburger this good before? So anyway, that can be an issue. So you want to have the person track their calories and not overeat. And then the last one is, I should mention this. Patients who are on these drugs because of the increased sodium, increased water retention, will make their weight go up even if they keep their calories under control. So they might appear overweight even if they're not, just from that water retention. All right, as far as the electrolyte goes, we already mentioned sodium, but for calcium, the big thing here is, what happens if you don't have enough calcium in your bones? What's that called? Brittle bones, what is it called? Little holes in your bones? Osteoporosis. So, they are at increased risk for fractures. But it's not just, well, if you fall, you might break your hip. It's just standing around, you can shatter the vertebrae in your back. Now, have you ever seen someone who has a posture that just all of the time, and all you want to do is you're like, I straighten you out. There you go. Better. And I'm not talking about just bad posture. I'm talking about like... And as it turns out, a lot of times those patients can't. Because if they've had vertebrae fracture, instead of little stacked vertebrae like this, they have little wedge vertebrae. What's happening to the patient's spine? You see the difference? So if they have compression fractures, that is going to cause kyphosis, but also lordosis. My wife's grandmother, when she died, you know, they lose height, and they lose height because their spine is now curved like that. So I thought that she had a deformity of her scapula. It turned out that that was her spine. So her thoracic spine was over here. Now, let's just simulate that for a moment. Everyone, round your shoulders forward as much as you can and hunch like this. And now, take a deep breath. Is it easy to breathe like that? No. So, patients who have this are at risk for two things. One, decreased ability to breathe. We'll talk about that for the next test. And then the second one is chronic pain. Because what comes off of your spinal cord? Nerves. And if those nerves are being impinged by the mechanical deviation of your spine, that can lead to chronic pain. So they lose height, they have deformity of the spine, leading to potential chronic pain, increased risk for pneumonia because they can't breathe as well. If they already have a lung problem, like asthma or COPD, it's going to make that worse. And then it also puts them at risk for fractures if they fall. So it's not just, okay, try not to fall. It's, there's more to it than that.
So my friend, she had like PCOS, and they gave her steroids, and she has like literally every single one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And she had like sclerosis. Is there anything to do for it? Does she even have like this whole face?
Polycystic ovary syndrome is a really interesting thing. They tend to have more testosterone than the average woman, sometimes like 2 to 3 times as much, which makes them really good athletes. But it also causes a number of other problems. And so to fix that, sometimes we'll give them steroids, or sometimes we'll give them birth control pills to try and suppress the testosterone production. But yeah, when you're on chronic steroids, you get these things. So she hasn't been on that in like a while?
No, she got it when she was 14. Mm-hmm. She like had to go to the hospital because she almost like passed out, and they gave it to her. And she's like 20 now, and she's still like 11 with like a little thing.
Yeah, she needs to do strength workouts, eat enough protein, and track her calories. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, once you have that shape, it's a hard road to get back to normal. All right, but wait, there's more. We also have to add in one more down here, which comes out of nowhere, which is cataracts. So cataracts are not related to protein metabolism. They're just an opacity of the lens. And it has no, it just comes out of nowhere. But patients who are on steroids tend to have more cataracts. That's going to make their vision dim and blurry, and the only cure for it is to give them a cornea transplant, at least at this time. You can surgically remove them, but sometimes, depending on how bad it is, they'll need a cornea transplant. Oh, that's a lot of stuff. Just for just one little drug. So steroids are no joke. The other thing about steroids is the way that they're made. So your body doesn't store cortisol in the adrenal gland for later use. It produces it as it needs it and secretes it at that time. So if you remember back to ANP2, there's a little thing in your brain called a hypothalamus. And that releases a little something that goes down to a little gland. What's that gland called? The pituitary gland. And then that secretes something called adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH. That goes down to your adrenal gland and tells your adrenal gland to produce cortisol. High levels of cortisol go back up to your pituitary and say, well, cool, man, we got the message. And then that lowers the dose of ACTH, the level of ACTH. And then that tells your adrenal gland, don't produce as much. So that's a negative feedback loop. The more cortisol you produce, the less ACTH you have, which then tells the adrenal gland, it's okay, you don't need to produce as much. So what do you think happens when you give a drug that is essentially mega doses of cortisol? What happens to the level of ACTH being produced by your pituitary? It goes to zero. So what does that do to the cortisol production in your adrenal gland? No, you say it. It goes to zero too, right? So imagine for a moment that you've been taking one of these drugs for a week or three, and how much adrenocorticotropic hormone does your body have right now? Not a lot. How much cortisol is your body producing? Not a lot, maybe none. So now, all of a sudden, you stop taking the drug, and what happens? You have no cortisol production whatsoever, and you go into a condition called adrenal crisis, acute adrenal crisis. And basically, you get the opposite of all these things. So instead of high blood sugar, what do you get? Low blood sugar. Instead of high sodium, what do you get? Low sodium. Instead of high blood pressure, what do you get? low blood pressure. And your patient can die from that low blood pressure. So, what do you think we might do about that? Well, okay, we're going to put them back on a steroid, and then we're going to gradually decrease the dose. And what's the fancy name for gradually decrease the dose? Taper. So, going back to methylprednisolone, in the oral form, there's something called a Medrol dose pack. So when you get that little pack, it's a little foil thing, and it's got little, they call them blister packs. So they're labeled. So how many pills do you take on day one? Five. How many do you take on day two? Three? Four? Yeah. So you can see that the number is going down until you get down to one. So this is a self-tapering prescription. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's only used for a short-term thing. But you still use that principle anytime a patient's been on steroids for a significant amount of time. You don't withdraw them acutely. You taper them down. And that's to avoid what problem? Acute adrenal crisis. Okay. Yeah, acute adrenal crisis. All right. The last thing we need to mention is that there's a difference between normal dose and super high dose. So, for example, methylprednisolone. One of the very most common things that you're going to see methylprednisolone used for is COPD. So COPD is an inflammatory disease in the lungs leading to chronic bronchitis and emphysema. Patients come in with what they call an exacerbation of that. They've got nasty, gross sputum and it's just not doing very well, and we need to get their inflammation under control really quickly. So we give them either IM or IV methylprednisolone. And the dose of that is typically going to be something like 40 to 60 grams. And you might give that 3 times to 4 times a day. So what would the total dose be if you're giving it, say, 4 times a day? I know this higher math is hard. No.
4 times?
What's 4 times 40?
160.
160. You said 1600.
Oh.
Yeah. All right. So you're going to give over the course of a day maybe up to 240 milligrams. And that would be considered a very high dose. Now, if a patient is having transplant rejection, then they could be having 1,000 milligrams IV at once. When you're giving those mega high doses, you're no longer suppressing inflammation, you're suppressing immunity. And the super high dose of steroid will actually kill T cells. And so it's not just suppressing now, it's actually destroying existing immune response. That also makes it so that we can use these drugs in cancers of the white blood cells. So if you have a leukemia that is lymphocytic, where you've got large numbers of T cells being produced, you can actually use steroids to treat that type of cancer. All right, any questions about steroids? It's a big topic. There's lots to know about it. You just got to know about it. You're talking about, you know, what kind of drugs do you see all the time? You're going to see methylprednisolone all the time. Any other questions? Okay, you didn't actually ask a question. I just assumed it. All right. On that note, let's move on to our next topic. And I think the only topic that we have left was wound healing. Is that right? All right. So wound healing. You know, he said early on that the purposes of inflammation, one of them was to prepare the body for wound healing. And that's the last thing we have to talk about. All right, so let's imagine for a moment two different kinds of wounds. In the first one, the patient goes into the hospital, and the doctor uses a very, very, very sharp instrument, cuts into them, and now you've got very clean edges, and you've got a very clean wound, because they disinfected the skin first, or whatever you call it, not disinfect. You can't disinfect skin. Say again? Antiseptized?
Sterilized?
It's not really sterile because you can't sterilize skin. But anyway, you whatever. You prep their skin. So there's fewer bugs on it. Really clean wound. Nice edges. And then you close those together with something. What something could we close those together with? Okay, so stitches, we're going to call those sutures. What else? Staples. Say again? Glue. Steri-strips. So tape. Alright, but in some way, we're going to join these edges together. Right? Where do you think the healing, how does the healing go? Well, it's going to go from both directions. Now, what do you think the advantages of this are? Is it going to be faster or slower than if you leave the wound open? It's going to be faster. Are you going to have a bigger or larger scar? Say bigger or larger. Bigger or smaller scar. Yeah. Heads I win, tails you lose. So it's going to be a smaller scar. What about risk for infection? Smaller because the skin is closed, so it's acting as a barrier. So those are some of the advantages of primary intention is what it's called. So primary intention. Now what's the downside of primary intention, or what are some potential complications? What if we close up something else inside here? Leave behind a surgical gauze. They call, by the way, gauze in the OR, they call them sponges. So the first time you go in, they're like, how many sponges do we have? And you're like, I don't see any sponges at all. It's gauze. Yeah. So maybe you leave a gauze sponge in there or something else. You've got a source of potential infection. So one of the downsides of these is if you leave something in there, it's more likely to cause a problem. Second issue is you can't close the wound after a certain amount of time. And that's typically going to be about 8 hours. So if the wound has been open for longer than 8 hours, the risk of infection is so high that when you close it up, you could be making the infection worse. So if you cut yourself and you're like, I'll go to the emergency room later. Yeah. It might be too late for them to close, then you'll have to heal the other way. So what do you think the other way is called? Secondary. So in this case, we have not closed the wound. What's the only possible way for this to heal? It's from the bottom up. So it's going to be slower, a lot slower. There's going to be much larger scar, higher risk of infection. But, depending on the type of wound, sometimes the only choice is secondary intention. Alright, any questions about wound healing? There's stages, I guess I should talk about that too. So it's generally speaking a three-step process. The first step is called regeneration. You have to regenerate functional tissue. Second step is called scarification. So you have to build a scar, that network of connective tissue, which is collagen. And then the third step, you actually destroy the inflammatory components that were there helping to repair the tissue. So if you've ever cut yourself, you probably notice that as it heals, the area is slightly pinker than usual because there's more blood flow to the area. But then eventually that goes away. What you're left with, at least in a lighter skinned person, is a white scar. And the reason for that is that after the wound is completely healed, that extra blood vessels were destroyed, and you don't have that excess blood flow to that area anymore, leading to a pale line. In the case of a darker skinned person, it's usually a darker line. And that's pretty much it for wound healing. We're not going to go over the stages of cell growth. You can read about that on your own, and it's not going to be on your test. So, on that note, we are done with inflammation. One of the biggest topics for Pathopharm 1. Cut! Yes. It's funny, if you've ever recorded video, like, for the purpose of editing, you've got to wait much longer than you think. You're like, you feel like you're waiting forever, and then you go to edit it, and you're like, that was like half a second. You need to wait longer. Yeah. But anyway, do you guys need to take a break before we move on? Still early? We're good?
I think we're still good.
All right.
Yeah, I know you.
Well, you guys are shifted, so it's like...
You want some gum?
No, I'm good, thanks. Like, last time you guys were more centered, and there are a few of you around the room, so it was like a natural. But now I'm like, I'm just teaching you here. So you're in the center, so... Yeah, there's no one right there for me to teach there anymore. Yeah, shift over. The things we do for a good video. Have you ever seen that movie, this little Facebook video, How Millennials Propose?
No.
So there's a guy who's going to propose to this girl. They're like on this little mountainside. And he's like, Anne Marie, will you marry? And she's like, wait a minute. You got a videographer, right? and she's like, yeah, he's right over there. So she's like, so then she's like, okay, just wanted to make sure. Let's go again. And then she's like, wait a minute. Why am I in the background? I think you should be in the background. Can you come over here to this side? Oh, wait a minute. This lighting is no good. Let's turn this way. And so, like, take 47. And then eventually, it's like, and she goes, I'm not feeling the production values here. He's like, well, what are you expecting? La La Land? And then at the end, they have this, like, really nice engagement video. And she's like, look, 147 likes.
I get it.
Get what?
She doesn't like La La Land.
What's La La Land?
It's a movie.
It's a great movie.
It's not a great movie.
I love the song.
Well,
it's not amazing, but it was good.
It was okay.
Are you going to the thing tomorrow? The symphony concert? It's the children's one, so I know
you're... No. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not cultured anymore. Ever since we had kids, no culture. Yeah, we took... Yeah, we took Logan to a production of the Dr. Seuss Cat in the Hat musical. And so they were playing all this fancy music and, like, exciting stuff at the beginning. And so, you know, we got there, and after about 20 minutes, then the guy comes out on stage, you know, the professor is in charge of the whole thing, you know, give a little introduction. And so everything, the whole room goes quiet. And then Logan goes, all right, guys, it's time to go home now. It's pretty funny. So he only lasted like another 20 minutes and he's like, I'm done.
Which Publix do you go to?
Publix?
One on Lakeford Road or the one across from?
State Road 7.
I'm by you?
Yeah.
By the car wash?
Yep. Most of the time. But we don't really shop there very much because it's, well.
Which Target do you go to? Do you go to the one on Lakeward? Both. Lantana?
Both.
See, it's right in the middle of my house. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I don't know which one to go to, but I work in the one.
Yeah.
Over winter break.
Yeah. I know where this stuff is in the Okeechobee one better, so.
See, I don't. They're much more rude in there.
Yeah. I don't know about that.
It could be so weird, like, if I go to dinner and I see you, because I study at dinner.
Where do you go to dinner?
Everywhere at Roadhouse, mainly. I know you. Olive Garden.
Habit, right there.
Yeah. I don't really like Habit Burger very much.
I like them, like, when I crave them.
Yeah, most of the time we do takeout.
Yeah.
No,
what are you doing?
The Texas Roadhouse is really good. What we usually do is get the tenderloin tips. So you can get the tenderloin tips is like $20 and you get like two sides and bread and a salad.
No, but Wednesday night you can get the 10 ounce for $9.99.
10 ounce what? Oh, I was saying the tenderloin, sorry. Tenderloin? Okay, so, well, here's a cow. It's a hippopotamus cow. So there's two muscles that run like this in a tubular fashion, and it's the most tender part of the entire steak, of the entire cow, because it's like gets the least amount of work, and that's tenderloin. So filet mignon comes from that. Then, if you take a big chunk out of the whole thing like that, and then slice that up, you get what are called T-bone steaks. Well, and then...
Tidbit?
No, T-bone. So...
Where do tidbits come from?
I don't know. I have no idea. So a T-bone steak has a bone that looks kind of like a T, and on one side of it you have New York strip, and then on the other side of it you have a smaller piece of filet. So depending on the front versus the back, this will be a bigger proportion. So porterhouse is when you have a bigger piece of filet of the tenderloin, and then T-bone is you have a smaller piece of it. But I'm not a huge fan of that because they don't cook the same. Like, this is better rarer than this is. So,
you know. I don't like any red.
Yeah.
Really? I like medium.
So you don't like steak, is what you're saying?
I like medium well. Medium well.
You. Anyone who likes well done steak does not like steak.
Well done, like done. I don't even know the word, so I don't order steak for myself.
No pink at all.
No pink.
Yeah. See, that's called ruined.
So have you had their margaritas? Oh,
no. Sounds kind of odd.
I know, sangria and margarita mixed together. But you have to get it frozen.
Sangrita? Sangarita. I don't know.
It's causing a lot of pain.
Alright. On that note, let's talk about pain and pain management. So the first thing we have to do is define pain. Now, this turns out to be really difficult. So, what do you think pain is?
Discomfort.
Discomfort. Okay. Say?
Ow.
Ow. All right, what else? Now you've moved too far over.
Just pick a spot else.
That's a two over.
Oh, really?
All right, so pain is generally defined as a negative sensation and perception that also involves emotion and other stuff. So, first we're going to go over what's called the medical model of pain, and then we're going to go over newer research that shows that it's more complicated than that. So, the general steps of pain is we're going to draw our little alien. Oh, yes, the alien. All right, so let's imagine that something happens down here. Maybe gets hit by a hammer, or maybe gets a bee sting. But there's some event that stimulates a pain receptor. What's the fancy word for a pain receptor again? A nociceptor. So the nociceptor is stimulated, and that then sends a signal up to the spinal cord. And in the spinal cord, there's a synapse. Oh, okay. Nociceptor. And what is the root word for noci in this case? Noxious. All right, so there is a synapse, and then we send a signal up into the brain. And then in the brain, there's some processes that occur, and then we send a signal back down to the synapse. And that signal says either, shut up, you lazy bum, or, hey, tell me more. So the four steps then, step number one is transduction. And there's two terms left to talk about with that. Then we have conduction, which is the nerve transmission itself. So the receptor being stimulated is transduction. Conduction is the nerve sending that up the pathway. Then the next two are kind of together, and that's perception and modulation. So modulation is when the brain sends that signal back down to modulate the signal that's being sent up to the brain. Does that make sense? Now, do you have to have all four of these components in order to have pain? No. How many of you were spanked as a child? How many of you ever had this experience? They're like, okay, bend over, we're going to spank you. And you're like, ow! And they haven't even touched you yet. And you weren't just saying, ow, it really hurt. When you guys get into the clinical, you're going to be starting IVs sometimes or giving injections. And some patients are like, ow, it hurts, it hurts. And you're like... How many ever heard of phantom limb pain? What is that? You chop off part of the limb, and then they feel pain where there's no arm. Can there possibly be a nociceptor being stimulated there? Okay, so you can actually have pain perception without having all four steps. In addition to that, the perception and the modulation are highly regulated by cues. What's a cue? A signal. Something in the environment. Your mood. Now here's the other thing. The perception of pain will also influence your mood. Does that make sense? So, pain is really complex. And this very simple model, it actually used to just stop at step three, is referred to as the medical model of pain. So, you got injured. Signals are sent up to your brain. You perceive that as pain. Then that's it. And as it turns out, it's not that simple. So let's break down some of the things that we need to think about along the way. So the first one in transduction. First of all, you have to have a stimulus. But it's not enough just to have a stimulus. What do you need? Okay, it needs to activate nociceptors. But in order to activate that nociceptor, how much stimulus is the key? So imagine for a moment that we took a sharp needle and we rested it on your skin, just resting. And it's a very light needle. Is it hurt?
Yeah.
Well, it's hurting, Ashley. And then we begin to apply a little bit of pressure. Does there come a moment where you're like, ow? And up until then, it didn't really hurt, right? So you need to overcome a certain level of something before you get the pain. And that level of whatever it is, stimulus, is called threshold. Women typically have a higher threshold than men. You don't even feel the pain.
Oh, because of labor.
Yeah. Your body's designed for labor. Now, that's an interesting point, because different stimuli can have different thresholds. Threshold also happens to tend to change with hormonal balance and with mood and across the day. So we typically have a higher threshold in the morning than we do in the afternoon. So even though 2:30 is a really convenient time to have your dental appointment, Yeah, I knew someone who they always set their appointment for 2:30 so I wouldn't forget when it was. Because that's 2:30. But from the perspective of threshold, you're better off doing it in the morning. If the shoe fits. All right. So that idea is threshold. When we get to the conduction, blah, blah, not a big deal. We're going to break down conduction in a bit more detail when we talk about anesthetics, local anesthetics. So we'll talk about that at that time. Then as far as the perception goes, some of it is learned. It's cultural. It has to do with your family. If you come from a family that's very expressive, you're more likely to experience pain at lower levels of stimuli. Another thing is expectation. How many of you love massages? How many of you? No, massages hurt. Yeah. Okay. Same thing is happening, rubbing those muscles, but in one person is like, oh, that hurts. And another person is, oh, that feels so good. Now, if someone was pushing you that hard outside of the context of a massage, would you experience that as pain, perhaps?
Yeah,
if someone like wrestling with you and they're like putting you like, and you're like, ow, that hurts. But in the context of this is supposed to be relaxing, you're okay with it. So now I'll give you a little example of how this can play out in real life. So there is a condition in shoulders that's known as impingement. So in some patients, they can't, everyone try this for a second. Take your arm like this. And now, try and lift your elbow higher than your shoulder. No, your elbow. Can you do it? It's kind of hard, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So as it turns out, anatomically, it's very difficult to do that. That's called impingement. And you can put someone into impingement by holding the shoulder down and pulling up on their shoulder. Now, some patients, for whatever reason, the way that the bones come together from the acromion process in the clavicle kind of naturally impinges on their shoulder and they'll experience pain, especially doing that. So that's called shoulder impingement syndrome. It never existed until the 60s when there was a surgeon who was examining cadavers and he noticed that some of them, the tendon was being kind of impinged by the bone there. But that didn't happen on all of the cadavers. So he came up with this idea that some people had impingement. And so he made this surgical technique where you kind of like shave down the bone and you relieve the impingement. And then he tried it on people and guess what? Shoulder pain got better. So what was the message that was told to these people? You have a mechanical problem. There's a bone pushing on your tendon and it's trapping it. What we have to do is we have to fix that anatomical problem with surgery, and when we do, you're going to get better. And so they did, and what happened? A lot of the times they got better. So now, years later, other people are like, I'm not so sure about this. In the meantime, physical therapy, surgery, the world has adopted impingement as a thing. But then some people started saying, well, is there really, really good evidence to show that this actually works? Well, what would happen if we just gave them physical therapy? Well, as it turns out, physical therapy is pretty much terrible for these people. For the vast majority of them, it doesn't work at all. So then they said, all right, well, what would happen if we took them and we cut their shoulder and we stuck a little camera in there and then pulled it out and sewed them back up and told them we did the surgery? They call that a sham surgery. So they did a trial where they had one group of people got physical therapy, one group got impingement surgery, and one got a sham surgery. The people who got the sham think they got the real surgery. Guess what? The sham surgery is just as good at relieving pain as the real surgery. What does that tell you? It tells you that a large portion of their pain was related to their expectations. Now, what if instead of telling them you have an anatomical problem that can only be fixed by surgery, you told them, we're not really sure what causes it. In a lot of patients, if you do these exercises, you could get better. The story in their head changes, and then that allows them to do better. Does that make sense? So, how many have ever heard this term before? Placebo. What is it?
Mind over matter.
It's not mind over matter.
Isn't it like mental, though?
Like, nope.
It's like when you think that you're getting...
Nope. Oh, say
again? It's, you know, how you think you're getting, like, and you're like, it's like an experimental trial. It's like when you're playing, like, saying, like, you're getting whatever, like, mm-hmm. drug or therapy done, but you think that you're getting the actual procedure done, mm-hmm.
All right, so it's the term that comes from research, and the idea is if you compare a treatment to a not treatment. But in order for this to work, the patient can't know it's not the treatment. So they think they're getting the treatment, but they're not. And what often happens is you see an improvement in both groups of people. So let's say that these people improve by 30%, and these people improve by 15%. This is not 30% better than no treatment. It's only 15% better than no treatment. Or placebo. Now, what is the key behind placebo?
Don't know.
They have to think they're getting it. Or at least not be certain. Yeah. There's a chance I might get the real thing. There's a chance I might get the placebo. I don't know. So I'm just going to have to assume I got the real thing because I feel better. Now, can you do the opposite of that? If you tell someone something is going to hurt, will that make them hurt more than if you didn't? And the term for that is nocebo. So the idea behind this whole idea, the idea behind this concept is that when we approach patients, we don't want to nocebo them in such a way that they have to experience pain because that's what we've set them up for. Does that make sense? Now, one of the most difficult things to deal with in our medical system is chronic pain. Chronic pain is just incredibly difficult to treat. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But one of the things you often find is that patients with chronic pain have a tendency to do less and less and less. Imagine for a moment that your shoulder hurt every time you did a certain movement. What would your parents tell you to do?
Don't do that movement.
So what happens over time? You end up in frozen shoulder where your shoulder can't do anything at all. If it hurts every time you walk, what do you have a tendency to do less of?
Walk.
Now, when you're not walking around and active, what does that do to your brain? How many of you had to stay in bed all day before? How do you feel? Crappy. And it can make some people depressed, right? Chronic pain by itself can lead to depression, but then the decreased movement can lead to depression. And the decreased movement, anytime I move, it's going to hurt. I'm expecting to hurt. What is that? It's a nocebo effect. One of the things that you as nurses will do to patients their very first day after surgery is you're going to tell them, hey, you got to get up and walk. And know what they're going to say? Are you insane? I'm broken. They've nocebo'd. And you're going to say,
yes, you can.
Yes, you can. And you're going to. And I'm going to make you. And you're going to get them up and walk. And it's going to hurt like heck. But you know what? They're going to get better much, much quicker than if you don't. So we have to help patients not accept nocebo. Now, another interesting thing that happens with chronic pain patients, this is not all the time, but some of the time, if you put them on a strength workout program, squats, deadlifts, that sort of thing, in a few weeks, like say they have chronic back pain, in a few weeks' time, sometimes they'll report that their pain is less. And sometimes, a couple of months later, they're like, you know what, I just realized my back pain is gone. Now, sometimes they still actually have it, and if you really delve into it, they still have it. But they no longer have limitations before. Before it was like, oh no, I can't do that, it'll hurt my back. Oh no, I can't do that. Oh, I can't walk this way, oh, I gotta be really careful. But through that training process, they've expected, it's a little discomfort, but it's not bad, I can work through that. And what they've discovered is that they are stronger than they realized. It's not necessarily about the muscles getting stronger, so much as it about their expectation of what does and doesn't hurt.
Sorry,
Or are they kind of like pushing their threshold?
Well, it's not necessarily related to transduction. It's more related to perception. Well, the threshold is a very technical definition. Anyway, but yes, I mean, something is happening. Now, the amount of pain you can stand is typically called tolerance. So how many of you have ever been told this by the dentist? You might not need some pain medication, but or, you know, some lidocaine, novocaine, but if you do, just, you know, just wave your hand and we'll stop and give you some.
Yeah.
And you're like...
That's annoying.
Yeah, and you're like... Yeah. So, you know, so there's a moment that you're like, that is too much, I can't deal with that anymore. That's kind of the idea of tolerance. So how much pain can you stand before it's like, ooh, that really is pain. So maybe they're building their tolerance. Maybe it's just about expectations. Think about a little kid who's got to give them, who's diagnosed with diabetes, and they've got to start giving themselves injections into their abdomen every day. How many of you have ever gotten a shot? When you got a shot as a little kid, what was it like? It was like the end of the world. No, don't do it! It's going to hurt! Oh, no! There's a needle! And then as you get a little bit older, you're like, got a shot. Yeah, it's bad. That didn't hurt at all. And then sometimes, it's like, if you got a nurse who's really good, he's like, did you give me the shot yet? They're like, oh, yeah. Now, the medication has an influence on that. Certain medications hurt going in, but it's not the needle that hurts, it's the medication. So you can stab a needle into a person this far, and they don't even feel pain if you do it well. What about people who do acupuncture?
Yeah.
So a lot of it has to do with expectations and context. And so what we want to do is put our patients in the best possible place to give themselves the context of, I am going to be better and I'm not going to feel pain. And that doesn't mean they won't feel pain immediately, but it means they'll be able to work through that pain and eventually it'll go away because they expect it to go away. On the other hand, if you expect to be debilitated and you expect to feel pain for the rest of your life, guess what's probably going to happen? It's probably going to come true. So this is like relatively new areas for pain research. So we don't know all the specifics, but we know some things and we're beginning to learn more. So on that note, let's talk about some more specifics of mechanics of pain. So the first thing we need to talk about is acute versus chronic. In acute pain, you have an acute stimulation of that nociceptor. Maybe you got run over by a car, maybe you got hit in the face, maybe you got a sunburn, maybe you got stung by a bee, but there is some event that occurred. And that is the direct cause of your pain. Does that make sense? So acute pain is most often accompanied by a sympathetic response. So what is a sympathetic response? What mediates it, first of all? Okay, it's fight or flight, but mediated by what? We were just talking about it not too long ago. It's just above your kidneys. Adrenal glands produce epinephrine, and your nerves are stimulated to secrete norepinephrine. And so you have norepinephrine, epinephrine, alpha 1, what happens? Vasoconstriction. Beta 1, what happens?
Heart
rate goes up. Okay. What happens? What about sweat? Yeah, it often starts sweating. If you ever see someone who's really bad acute pain, their face tends to be very pale. They're often sweaty. They look like they saw a ghost. They're like, what is wrong with you? Have you ever seen someone like that who's in a lot of pain? Maybe someone has kidney stones, for example. It's like, and then cold sweat. Okay. So all of that goes into the sympathetic response. So patients with acute pain, especially severe acute pain, what do you expect to see? Sympathetic response. So pallor, diaphoresis, elevated heart rate, elevated blood pressure, and they often have guarding. What is guarding? It's like, don't move that thing. So let's say that you broke your, well, broke. Let's say you hurt your elbow really badly. So what do you tend to do? Rigidity around it to immobilize it and prevent it from moving. That's called guarding. Chronic pain, on the other hand, is typically pain that has been around for about 6 to 8 weeks. There's no longer necessarily an identifiable cause. Does that make sense? So there could have been originally, but now there shouldn't really be a cause of it anymore. And chronic pain, patients will typically lose that sympathetic response. A patient who's in acute pain, they're going to look like they're in pain. A person who's in chronic pain might tell you, my pain is a 10 out of 10. And what do they look like? Normal. And so what's the tendency to think about them? They're lying. They just want drugs. And that's an unfair assumption. So an important thing to remember when you're dealing with a patient with chronic pain is that you can't feel or see their pain. So what do you have to do? You have to believe them. Or not. But I mean, those are your only two choices. You either believe them or you don't. So we need to work hard at establishing rapport with patients and a history with patients so that they are more likely to tell us the truth. And so that we are more likely to accept what they say. Which is one of the reasons why it's really scary when a chronic pain patient has their doctor retire. Or if they move to another city, because now they're with a new doctor who doesn't know them, who doesn't have a reason to trust them, and it's like, what if they're just lying so that I'll give them opioids? There's an opioid epidemic, you know. So that can be very scary for a person with chronic pain. Another distinction that we have in terms of pain types is visceral versus somatic. So, how many of you have ever hit your thumb or finger with a hammer? Somatic pain. How many have ever gotten kidney stones or gallstones or some other internal problem? So, if the pain is being caused by an internal organ, that's typically called visceral. And visceral pain is typically more difficult to deal with than somatic pain. Because your body isn't really designed for the somatic pain. Now, I'm going to say a very controversial thing. For visceral pain. Yeah. I'm going to say something very, very controversial in a room full of women. Kidney stones hurt worse than labor and delivery. That is impossible, Dr. Heyman. You are not a woman. You do not know. Well, okay, that's fine. I mean, I have had kidney stones and I haven't had a delivery, but I know women who have both given birth and had kidney stones. And you know what they say? All of them say? Kidney stones hurt worse. Want to know why that is? Because your body is designed for delivery. It's not designed for kidney stones. Well, I mean, there is a perception to it, but it's just the nature of that type of pain. Visceral pains hurt worse than somatic pains, and labor and delivery is a somatic pain. What can you say? So, back to our story. Theories of pain. There's a couple different theories of pain. One of them is called the summation theory, and it's the idea that you have to have enough stimulus to actually trigger pain. And the example that I would use is if you've ever dated someone, and you, what do you do when you first start dating someone? What's like that first little sign of affection? Holding hands. And it's just so exciting to hold their hand. Oh my goodness. And then they start doing this. And at first you're like, oh, that's kind of cute. And then you're like, you know, it's kind of annoying. And then you're like, would you stop that? It hurts! Can you relate to what I'm saying at all? That, you know, you might have a stiff... No, you can't at all.
I don't understand how it turns into
pain. Yeah. I
know my mom likes to do this, and when it's rubbing for a while, it starts getting really annoying.
Well, but eventually it could actually hurt.
My mom.
And then also the idea, like with the massage. If you do the massage hard enough, there's a moment where you're like, it hurts, but it's good, and then it's bad. Mm-hmm. So that would also be an example of the summation theory of pain. Then we have what is known as the gate theory of pain, and the gate theory of pain is based around this idea right here in the synapse that when you have conduction of signals up to the brain, there's only so many signals that can go through that synapse. So if you introduce competing signals, you will inhibit the pain signal. An example of that. All right. How many of you have ever crushed a finger in a doorway or by a hammer or something else? What's the very first thing you do?
Shake it.
You shake it and you put it in your mouth.
Yeah.
What are you doing? You're introducing competing stimuli that are competing for the pain. Actually makes it feel better, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that nurses used to do back when they had time is for all their patients, they would give them a back rub after dinner. And so, first of all, there's incredible power in the human touch. But also, you're stimulating large amounts of skin with a non-painful stimulus. And that helps to reduce a person's pain perception and encourage relaxation. Does that make sense? When you guys get to the end of your health assessment course, there's a little section on spiritual assessment and on, developmental assessment. In the spiritual assessment part, we actually talk a little story about a guy who had a surgery and the pain that he felt afterwards and how it impacted his spiritual well-being and how having a different attitude changed his perception of pain. So in addition, your mood and expectations can have a vast impact on how you feel. Now, one thing we have to mention is that when a person is feeling pain acutely and they have a sympathetic response, how do you think they might react emotionally speaking? Snappy. Yeah, a little hangry. Yeah, the sympathetic response can make a person more irritable. And if someone's in pain, things that might not ordinarily bother them more. So not only does it affect the physical, it affects the mental and potentially social and even spiritual dimensions. Someone who's in pain might be a little angry at God. Why have you done this to me?
Why have you done this to me?
Someone who's in chronic pain can feel that too, but they don't have the sympathetic excuse anymore. There's one more thing I was going to mention. Oh, and mood. So, laughter and music have been shown to decrease pain ratings. So, if you can have a person do something enjoyable or something that's funny, then, or just, enjoy something, that can take their mind off the pain. How many of you have ever been involved in sporting events? Have you ever hurt yourself? But you're like, no, I can do it. I'm going to play. And you kept going. And it wasn't that bad. And then the next day, you couldn't move. So back when I was a bit fatter than fitter, I was like, I used to do boxing when I was young. Let me do some boxing. So they have the boxing boot camp things, whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I'll do one of those. Groupon, okay. So I went the first day, and I was like, I don't really have any shoes that are appropriate for this anymore. Maybe I should get some shoes. So I bought some new shoes and they're there first day and the shoes were like on their mat. And they're like, okay, we're going to do a burpee and you get back up and you punch, whatever. And so I got down to the burpee and my shoe went and I sprained my big toe.
Oh my gosh.
Like 5 minutes into the workout. Hurt like heck. But you know what? It's not that bad. I can still, limp to the car. See you guys next week, man. Next day, couldn't walk at all on that toe. It took like 3 weeks to get better. But that day, in the moment with the focus of the workout, it's not bad. It's a little bit, but okay, I can do it. So some of it is your expectation. Does that make sense? And also your drive and your motivation. You know, sometimes wives will be like, well, look at that sporting person. They had a flu and they played the whatever, and you won't even go take the trash out. He's got a $21 million contract on the line. I got nothing. So anyway, and a lot of that has to do with how you try and motivate a man. You know, this is beyond the scope of Path of Arm, but just for the moment, you know, generally speaking, men tend to run on respect, whereas women tend to run on love. So when the woman says, "How come you don't do anything around here?" What she's really saying is, if you love me, you would do things around here. But he didn't perceive, I want you to be my hero and do stuff around here. What he perceived was, I don't respect you. You're a slob. So the way to get the man to do what you want is to be like, honey, you're so good at that. I love it when you do that for me. Could you help me with that? Oh, sure, I'll be your hero. I'll do that for you. What was that?
You said so much time wasted.
I mean, that's just so much more effort. It's like, can you go do this?
Yeah, but it's the difference between marital bliss. It's the difference between marital bliss and, you know, not. Have you ever heard of the crazy cycle? Alright, so the crazy cycle is when, it doesn't matter who starts it, but in this case we'll start with the husband. So the husband is unloving towards his wife. That triggers disrespect in her, which triggers unlovingness in him, which triggers disrespect in her, and so it's like this cycle of very, very common in marriages. And the thing is, it's like, this is the most natural thing to do. You see, you really have to try hard not to do that. All right, back to our story. So, pain. I think we've covered all the stuff we need to talk about pain before we get to actual pain management. So, with pain management, first thing we have is non-pharmacological measures. And we already talked about not noceboing patients. That is critical to the idea of pain management. Now, this can be a little bit difficult because one of the things we have to do with nurses is we have to guide them into what to expect. So after surgery, guess what? It's going to hurt, right? And it's okay to say, look, chances are after surgery, you're going to have some pain. But, and you're going to feel what you might feel, like you can't walk. But guess what? You can. And you're going to, and that's going to help you get better faster. Does that make sense? So you're empowering that person, and you're giving them a story that moving through the pain is going to make me better, right? But giving them the story of, this is going to hurt, it's going to hurt so bad, it's going to be the worst pain you've ever had in your life, and you're not going to be able to move, what story is that sending them?
Negative.
That's sending them a negative story. I don't have the power, the pain will control me. And so what we have to do is we have to put power into the patients, give them the power to be able to overcome the pain. Don't give them a story that the only way to get out of the pain is surgery, as we've seen with the impingement. Now, it might be true, but it's not always true. So we don't want to give them the story that in their head there's no escape from their pain. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's the first thing. Then, non-pharmacological treatments can include gate three of pain remedies, like you can either squeeze, let's say they hurt this side, if you squeeze the other side so hard it hurts too, well, they'll forget about the first side. Not the most effective. You can give back rub. You can do just a setting change. So opening the blinds, getting them up in bed, helping them to feel more like a normal person. How many of you have ever been like really sick and you didn't groom at all for like 2 or 3 days? And then one day you're like, you know, I need to like take a shower, like get dressed and do my hair. And then all of a sudden you feel like a more normal person, even though you're still sick and you don't feel good. And so doing those activities of daily living can be very helpful in helping a person to maintain their pain. Other things include, we talked about art therapy, music therapy, humor. Even aromatherapy can be helpful. Spiritual maintenance is extremely important when it comes to pain. So all those things would be considered non-pharmacologic. Now, when it comes to pharmacologic, here's where we get to the fun part. So the first thing we have to do is we have to take a little bit deeper look at the conduction portion of nerve transmission. So, tell me what the parts of the neuron are again. All right, so you got an axon. Axon terminal. Cell body. What are these little guys? Dendrites. Now, this is a traditional, I call this the thermometer version of a neuron, but not every neuron looks like this in terms of scale. Some of them have very long dendrites and short axons, and whatever. But the important thing is that we have to send a signal from down here all the way up through the axon. We've already talked about what happens here at the synapse, which is we release what? Neurotransmitter. But what tells the neurotransmitter to leave in the first place is a signal coming down. What kind of signal is that? Well, that's the name of it. What kind of signal is it?
Chemical.
All right. So, a chemical, not exactly. It's an electrical. Which is why if you connect an electrode up to a patient's nerve, it'll stimulate their nerve. So, now, I don't want you to think of this as a neuron. I want you to think of it as a nightclub. Now, if you have a nightclub and you want to attract guys to the club, what do you need inside the nightclub? Women, girls. So, in the case of the nightclub, these are going to be negatively charged proteins. They've got a line because they're negatively charged. Now, the guys in this situation are positively charged ions. And we all know the guys come in two shapes. Cool kids and nerds. So, every good nightclub has a bouncer. And you're going to bounce the nerds out, and you're going to let the cool cats in. So what happens over time? Only the cool kids are in, and all of the nerds are out. Now, those nerds want to come in because of the electrical charge. They're attracted to the electrical charge. And they're not allowed to come in, so there's more positives on the outside than you would expect. That means that the inside of the cell is negatively charged. And what's the outside of the cell? Positively charged. So that sets up a polarization. Now, if you look up here for a second, I chose this hand motion very specifically. It's a polarization. Why is that? Why did I choose that? What's that like?
Zero.
So what's... Oh, Katniss, right, yeah. So, bow and arrow. How many of you ever shot a bow and arrow? Yeah. Do you shoot a bow and arrow like this?
No.
How do you shoot the bow and arrow? You gotta like pull it back and it's like a muscle workout, right? Okay. So, does it take energy to stay right here? Well, obviously, I'm shaking. Okay. So, now what? Is the arrow moving? The arrow is at what? It's resting. But it takes energy to maintain it, right? Okay. These bouncers, takes energy to run the bouncers. The bouncers are called sodium potassium pumps. So it takes energy to run those pumps. It takes energy to run those pumps in the form of ATP. But we call it resting potential. Why is it resting? The cell isn't resting, it's taking energy. What's resting? The charge is resting. So just like when you shoot an arrow, it takes energy to pull the bow back. The arrow is at rest. Now, does it take energy to let the arrow go? Does it take energy to let the arrow go? Nope. That's a passive process because you have already stored the energy inside the bow. The energy here is in the form of what? What's it called when we have a separation? A difference.
Gradient.
A gradient. What kind of gradient have we set up? On the electrical gradient. So, we've set this place up, this situation up, where there's enormous amount of tension, and that sodium is just trying to get in, but it can't get in because it's being bounced out, and the membrane doesn't let the sodium in. But so that's that tension. That resting potential is like a bowstring being pulled back. It takes energy to keep it there, but the charge is resting. Now, when the signal gets sent, what do we call that? Not resting, it's action potential. Now, in every good nerd movie, there's a moment in the movie where someone opens up the doors of the club and all the nerds come rushing in, right? And that's basically what happens. We open up a little nerd door that allows the sodium to come inside. And as sodium comes inside up here, that changes the polarity of the cell. The cell begins to become more positive. So we call that depolarization. It was negative inside, positive outside. Positives come in, and that's called depolarization. So what happens is you sweep downwards, little nerd doors opening up all the way down the cell, and nerds coming inside. This step is also known as sodium influx. What does the word in mean?
Inside.
What does the word flux mean? Flow. So inflow. So the sodium is flowing in, the nerds are going inside the club. And that is what sends the signal all the way down. Does that make sense? So your action potential is caused by what? In every good nerd movie, there's a moment where the doors open. What are these doors called? They're sodium doors. Sodium channels. A sodium channel is a nerd door. So the sodium channels open up and allows sodium nerds to come into the club, the neuron. And that's the depolarization. And that's going to sweep down that cell until eventually you get to the end. And then that's what triggers the neurotransmitter release. Now, once the nerds invade the club, what do the cool cats say? This place is lame. I'm out of here. So the influx of sodium actually kicks potassium out of the cell. And then the nerd door is shut. The sodium-potassium pump kicks in again, and you start pulling the cool kids back in as you pump the nerds out. And that repolarizes the cell so that you've got another resting potential waiting to go. Does that make sense? All right. Now that we know that, how do you think we could design a drug that blocks nerve transmission? Now, that blocks neuromuscular receptors. We want to block the axon terminal from sending a message. If you block sodium channels, you will prevent the signal from being sent. And that's how lidocaine works. Now, lidocaine is not specific to just pain neurons. How many of you have ever gotten your mouth numbed at the doctor's office? In addition to blocking pain, I And then you try to eat the food and you bite your tongue. Right? And you try and smile and you're like... Or if they only on one side, you're like, I can't move my fiber. So, it can also block motor neurons, and it can also block other sensation besides just pain, depending on the dose of the drug. So that's how lidocaine works. We've already talked about what happens when you mix epi with lidocaine, so just remember that. And that's pretty much it. At resting, the cell is negatively charged. The membrane is positively charged.
So when you block the sodium
channels,
the cell stays negative?
Yes. So when you block the sodium channels, you prevent the cell from becoming depolarized, from becoming positive. All right, so that's how lidocaine works. That one is pretty simple once you understand the whole idea of nerd doors. Okay. Go ahead. No. The charge is resting. The cell is not resting. So resting potential is about the cell, is about the charge, not about the cell. And when I was in A&P and all that stuff, I'm like, how come it takes energy to rest? This is stupid. It wasn't until years later that I was like, oh, the charge is resting. So that's your Katniss Everdeen reference. The arrow is resting, but it takes energy to pull back the bow. All right, so that is lidocaine. Next, we're going to talk about opioid drugs. So, opioids work by activating opioid receptors. Now, what is the difference between opioid and opiate? Oid means like. So it's opiate-like. So there's only two opiates in the world, and that is morphine and codeine, because they come from the opium plant, the opium poppy. Everything else that's artificial or synthetic is not an opiate, it's an opioid. Does that make sense? Okay. There are a number of natural opioids in your body. So the two most commonly known ones are endorphins and enkephalins. And they're naturally produced in a number of circumstances. How many of you have ever been addicted to exercise? So, you do this grueling workout, and at the end of it, you're like, I can barely walk, oh, I'm so broken. And then about an hour later, you're like, oh man, life is good. Everything is good. Peace in the world. I just feel fantastic. And what's happened is you're actually high. So what you're experiencing is sometimes known as runner's high, although I've never experienced that running. But I have experienced it through karate and some other stuff. But running? Anyway, they call it runner's high. And what causes it is the release of natural endorphins after exercise. When we stimulate opioid receptors with drugs, you can get much, much higher levels of stimulation, which is going to lead to increased pain reduction. So the number one, now there's three different opioid receptors in your body. There's like mu, kappa, and epsilon, I believe it is. And in the notes, it actually talks about which drugs stimulate which things, and not on the test. So what we're going to focus on for the test is the actual physiological effects and the ones that we want to happen and the ones we don't want to happen and how we deal with the ones that we don't want. So, the number one thing that we want, the therapeutic effect of opioid drugs, what is it? Not high. Decrease pain. And what's the fancy word for pain or prefix or root for pain? Arthralgia, neuralgia, analgesia. So, what we want is analgesia, which is our analgesic effect. So, decrease pain. And not, a-ja, get it, analgia, an analgesic. Analgesic. Does that make... An, not, alga, pain, esic, thing that causes. Anyway, forget about it. We do reduction in pain. That's what we want. Now, there's another effect that we sometimes want, which is reduced cough. And you can actually, you'll sometimes see people who have an opioid prescription for a cough. So that is sometimes a therapeutic effect. But it could also be an adverse effect. If someone's got a lot of sputum and you're treating them with opioids for pain, that could make them more likely to hold on to the mucus, which in turn might not be that good for their airway. But for the most part, the reduction in cough we can consider a potential therapeutic effect. Sometimes it actually is used for that. The next thing we have is respiratory depression. Now, what does the word depress mean? If you have a button and you push on it, what's that called? If you push it down. Okay. All right, let's imagine you have a button that you push like this. What would that be called? Press.
Press.
Now, the button is facing this way and you push it down. What's it called? Depress. So to depress means to push down. So when we talk about respiratory depression, what exactly is getting pushed down? It's not the diaphragm. That happens all the time. We're talking about your respiratory drive. So how would a decreased respiratory drive be manifested? What would that look like? Health assessment wise.
Tripoding.
Not tripoding.
Fewer respirations
per minute. So what's your normal?
12 to 20.
So if a patient goes below 12, that's going to be considered respiratory depression. Are we going to do anything about that? Yeah, what? I don't know. The way you asked it, I just knew I had to do something. What are we going to do about a patient who's respiratory depression from their opioid? And the answer is, you're going to hold the next dose. So anytime you give a respiratory drug, or sorry, an opioid drug, what are you going to check? Respirations. If the respirations are less than 12, what are you going to do? Not give them that dose. But wait, there's more. What happens if their respiratory rate is less than 6? Now what are you going to do?
Intubate?
You just want to kill a person, don't you?
Call the physician?
Well, the answer is we have to intervene in some way, and we got to raise their respiratory rate. So there's a couple ways we can do that. One of the ways you can do that is by stimulating the patient. You have them get up and walk. Now, for some patients, you know, just like raising them up in bed and sitting them up in bed is like, raise their respiratory rate. But for a lot of patients, you're going to have to do more than that. Now, that might not be enough. So what else could you do? Give another drug? What kind of drug?
Beta-2 agonist.
Okay, well that would make their airway open, but it wouldn't necessarily make them breathe more. So not a beta agonist. What was the problem? They're not breathing enough. So what do we want them to do? Breathe more. And what kind of drug would make them breathe more? You're going to hate yourself when you realize what the drug is. Is it what? Say it!
It's wrong.
It might not be.
What is it?
Well, yes, those are wrong. Sorry.
I knew it was wrong. I didn't want to say it.
Well, we didn't know you were wrong until you said it, so there you go. Now you won't make that mistake again. I told you, this drug is so simple. You don't necessarily know the name, but the drug concept is so simple that you'd be like, duh. What's the cause of their respiratory depression? An opioid. So what would we... An anti-opioid. Okay. So an opioid antagonist. And the drug of choice there, well, the drug name you're going to learn anyway, is naloxone, which I'm sure you have heard of, Narcan. You've never, how many of you have heard of Narcan before? One person. Okay. Well, Narcan is the brand name for naloxone, and it's the antidote to an overdose of any opioid, including heroin. Some of you have seen those shows like where they have the addicts, and they're all like, and then they like give them a drug, and they're like, naloxone. Now, when you give a patient naloxone, and you block the, you unblock their opioid receptors so that the opioid gets kicked off, what's going to happen to the respiratory rate? It's going to increase. What's going to happen to their pain? It's going to increase also. So what we don't want to do is just give them whatever it is. Yeah, it says 2 cc's. 2 cc's in there, baby. What do you want to do? A little bit, wait, and you want to give just enough. When you give just enough, what is that term? What is the word for that? You're going to give them a little bit, just enough. Enough to get an effect. It's a chemical term. We're going to titrate. Yeah, in chemistry. Okay. So you're not just really going to slam the drug in there. You might not even give the entire dose. You want to give enough for the respiratory rate to recover, but not so much that the patient is now in extreme pain.
So that's like a big difference, either getting them up to walk or giving them naloxone.
Yes.
So how would you decide which one to do?
I don't know. You have to use your judgment in that situation. I'm just giving you options at this point. Yeah, so in case you didn't hear that, the question was, how do we know to choose between getting the patient up and walking or giving them naloxone? And the answer is, well, you got to make that decision at the time. So.
Is it possible that you gradually, like, giving them
no better
and
make
them walk as well?
Possibly, yeah. And the other thing is, like, if you have a patient who's at 6 versus a patient who's at 1, you know, that's a big difference. So the more gone they are, the more likely you are to use naloxone. Now, most hospitals nowadays, when an opioid drug is ordered, they are also going to order a naloxone dose PRN. So you, before you go, hey doctor, this patient's got respiratory depression and they're on an opioid, and do you think I could get some naloxone? Well, did you give what I ordered? Oh, well, let me get back to you. Hold on. You don't want to be in that situation, right? So, anytime you give an opioid, you want to also check for the naloxone dose, make sure you know what's there, make sure you know how to give it, all that stuff. With pediatrics, it's much more dangerous. They have a lower threshold for becoming respiratorily depressed than you do with adults. The more someone has taken opioids, so like a person who's been on them chronically or an addict, typically is going to have a much higher tolerance for the drug, so it'll take higher levels of the drug to make them respiratory depressed. Okay, so that is the second adverse effect that we've got here, respiratory depression. Then we have, no, go ahead.
If a person is like an addict, wouldn't it also take more to reach the level of going to decrease pain?
Yes, quite possibly.
Okay, so that could still put them under
respiratory. Right. Yeah, so it, you just have to see what you're dealing with. So the next one is going to be euphoria. Now, what does euphoria mean?
Yes.
Eu means good. Phoria means feeling. So I feel good. I knew that I would. So not. Sorry. So in colloquial terms, what would this be called?
High.
Now, the government does not like people feeling good. You're not allowed to be high. So that's why we have to not let you have access to these drugs. For your own good, you must feel bad. But could you feel bad on these drugs instead of good? How many of you ever had an opioid drug? Codeine, Percocet, oxycodone, something like that. And you were like, this is awesome? Or you're like, I don't really like how I feel. Well, throwing up is a different adverse effect. But it wasn't that good. So the opposite of euphoria is dysphoria. And quite a lot of patients hate the way it makes them feel. I don't like it. It's not good. That would be dysphoria. Then we have drowsiness. Increased drive to sleep. However, that sleep is not necessarily more restful. So opioids are not a good choice for insomnia. Even though they make you drowsy, they don't necessarily make you more refreshed. Then something that is related to that is mental clouding. Mental clouding can be anything from you just can't think quite straight to your reflexes are diminished and your judgment is impaired, which means that when you are on an opioid drug, you should not operate heavy machinery, aka an automobile, let alone a motorcycle. Does that make sense? All right. Also, got to be careful about potential falls. You know, just in general, you just have to be a little bit more careful. I had surgery once, and I was on opioid after the surgery, and someone rang the doorbell. I was upstairs like, oh no, I gotta go let them in. I took like two steps down the stairs, like, boom, 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 boom. I'm like, how did that even happen? your reaction times aren't quite as good as you thought. Your brain processes aren't quite as good as you thought. You just have to be more careful. All right, then we come to Ashley's favorite, which is nausea. And what goes along with nausea? Vomiting. Some patients will always get this with every opioid, no matter what. Others will only get it with select opioids. So maybe hydrocodone, which is in oxycodone, which is in Percocet, gives them nausea, but hydrocodone, which is in Lortab, does not. So it can vary by drug, or it doesn't matter which drug it is, it's all going to cause nausea. Typically, the higher the dose, the greater the nausea. How would you deal with nausea? And it's anti-nausea medication. What's the fancy-smancy word for vomit? Emesis. So a drug that prevents that would be called an anti-emetic. So you would give anti-emetics. Now, for the bonus prize, what route do you think you should not give an anti-emetic in this case? P.O. Why? Because you vomited back up. Now, if you're giving it ahead of time, pre-dosing, can you give it P.O.?
Yeah.
Yes. But if you're waiting until they're nauseated in order to give them the drug, then can you give it P.O.?
No,
because they might vomit it back up. What was I going to say there? Yeah, it doesn't matter. Okay, so nausea. Then the next one is constipation. Just slows down your guts. Now, there's a couple things that are important for this. First one is the three main things for general prevention of constipation. Number one is adequate hydration. Water makes stool softer. You need more water to keep your stool soft. Second is adequate fiber. And the third is physical movement. Getting up and walking and moving around will also help. But with a patient who's on one of these drugs, those three things might not be enough, in which case you would need a laxative. Stimulant laxatives are typically preferred, but you could also use an osmotic laxative. Now, don't worry, those terms don't mean anything to us right now, but if you're slowing down the gut, giving a stimulant will speed it back up. An osmotic laxative pulls water into the gut. And then, more water in the gut, less hardness goes out easier. The thing that does not work very well is what's called a stool softener. And the drug there that's typically used is called Docusate or Colace. If you see that, chances are good it ain't going to work very well. But for whatever reason, lots of doctors like to prescribe it in this situation. Habit. That's why they prescribe it.
Habit?
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
Yeah.
So what would you, like, was going to say, a lot of people get it just over the counter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Docusate is over the counter.
Is the other one available over the counter?
Yes. All of them are available over the counter. But in the hospital situation, it has to be ordered.
Yeah.
Now, outpatient, you can tell, you can tell the patient, hey, go to the pharmacy and get some Bisacodyl, some Ducalax, and take it every day. Stimulant laxative, or Senecot. But in the case of, or you can even give them Miralax, which is an osmotic one. But giving them Colace, it just doesn't work as well. One of the interesting things is, I had a neighbor once who was in a car accident where, he was like one of those people who delivers, drove a big rig and delivered building materials to road crews on the side of the road. So here's his truck on the side of the road, and here's the edge of the road, and here's him talking with these guys, and this car comes way over on the side, hits him. He goes flying through the air, almost tore his leg off, shattered his scapula, all of this just bad. And here he is, a couple months later, I'm like, where have you been? He's like, yeah, I was in this crazy car accident, blah, blah, blah. And he sort of got to talking, and he's like, and then the constipation, and they didn't warn me. I hadn't had a bowel movement in a week, and it was hurting so bad, and all this stuff. I'm like, they didn't warn you? I'm like, they didn't give him anything for an entire week. Now imagine that you had a week's worth of poo inside of you. Do you think that would hurt? How many of you have been constipated for one day? And the next time you go, it's like you thought you were going to, die. And then you look in the toilet, and it's, smaller than usual. And you're like... I give up. So imagine a week's worth of that. It's like... Nurses, you got to warn your patients. And this is not noceboing them. This is dealing with reality that, hey, chances are you might be constipated. If you are, we need to do something about that sooner rather than later. Next, we have urinary retention. Now, the way that this works is kind of twofold. The first is, when you go to the bathroom, how is it that you typically initiate the stream? What do? You relax, and what happens? Water comes out. All right. In the case of urinary retention, you relax and nothing happens. So what you have to do? You got to push. Now, once the stream starts, maybe you have to push a little bit, but once the stream starts, typically it just keeps going by itself until you're mostly done, right? Okay. Well, in the case of this, not only do you have to kind of push to get it started, you have to push to keep it going. Otherwise, it's going to stop. The other thing that happens is that there's just less urge to go. How many of you, if you think about water, it's like, oh, got to go. Yeah. It's like you're fine until it started raining in the car. And you're like, got to go. So in this case, though, it's just like, nope, don't got to go. So there's two things we have to do just one thing we have to do for our patient, which is encourage them to go. So I know you might feel like you don't have to go right now, but it's been about 4 hours, and I really need you to at least try and go to the bathroom. And try. Don't just, Yeah. Try. So that would be what we do for urinary retention. Next, let me see if I'm going to move this over here. What? Yeah, I know. It's like steroids. Only more so. All right, so then we're going to have meiosis. So we already learned about meiosis when we talked about cholinergic stuff. So what is meiosis? Pupillary constriction. And what is that going to do to their ability to see? They need brighter room. But now, this is one of the cases we get into addicts. Addicts who are addicted to opioids, like heroin, will often wear glasses to hide their little tiny pinprick pupils. Makes them look kind of like a reptile. They call it reptile eyes. So they use glasses to hide it, and then that makes it so they can't see as well, so they bump into stuff. So clear the room of things that they could bump into and keep it more brightly lit than usual. Next, we have itching. Opioid receptors are coupled to histamine receptors or something. Yeah, histamine receptors. So when you activate opioid receptors, you also release histamine and get histaminergic effects. So that causes itching. How can you solve the itching? Give an antihistamine. What's a fancy word for itching, by the way? Pruritus. Okay. All right, and there's one more we need to talk about, which is biliary colic. Now, what does biliary mean? Having to do with bile. Now, where is bile made? In the liver. And then it's secreted through a little series of ducts called the biliary tree. And then it collects in the gallbladder. Now, those little biliary ducts, for some, whatever reason, have little muscles in them. I guess like milk sit down, I guess. And sometimes those little muscles go... And guess what happens when you get that? Isn't it? Incredible pain. And that is sometimes triggered by opioid drugs. If an opioid causes biliary colic, there's really nothing you can do to fix them except take them off the opioid. Now, sometimes one drug will cause it for them and another one won't, so you might try switching opioids. But a lot of patients, the only thing you can do is take them off all opioids. Does that make sense?
And that happens at the tree?
And that happens in the tree before the gallbladder. All right. Did I miss any adverse effects from your notes there? I think I got them all. All right. We didn't talk about addiction. We'll talk about addiction after we finish talking about the rest of the drugs. But I believe we should take a break at this moment in time. Not really. It's time to go in 20 minutes.
Oh, is it really?
We should just push through.
No, let's just go.
All right.
Keep going.
I talk too much. How do I say so passionate what?
It's about teaching the same thing each year.
Well, it's new students. It's about the performance.
You do a great job. I really do.
So one of the reasons, well, even when I use PowerPoints, I'm like, the PowerPoint isn't the presentation. I am the presentation. So what we're going to talk about next is kind of a throwback to our last topic. What was our last topic before pain? The I word, inflammation. So these are analgesics, but they're also anti-inflammatories. So as it turns out, there is a substance in our bloodstream and various cells called arachidonic acid. We'll call it AA for short. And when you expose arachidonic acid to different enzymes, it can become different products. So there's one enzyme in particular called cyclooxygenase, which we conveniently abbreviate COX. So cyclooxygenase turns arachidonic acid into a group of substances called prostaglandins. And these prostaglandins control a number of physiological functions, including macrophage function, kidneys, platelets, and gastric mucus. When you have inflammation, though, there's a different kind of COX that is released, and that type of COX is called COX-2. And that causes a reduction in inflammation, which also results in lowered pain and lowered temperature. Oh, I forgot something on this side over here. Over here we also have uterine contractions. So, we can use drugs that block COX-1 and COX-2 to inhibit, oh, I'm sorry, I lied. Increased inflammation, increased pain, increased temperature. So, we can use COX, well, our body uses COX to promote these functions. These are called homeostatic functions. And then we can use COX-2 to increase pain, temperature, and inflammation. Now, we have drugs that block COX. These are called COX inhibitors. Never, you didn't think that would happen, did you? So, when you block COX over here, what do you get? You get decreased inflammation, decreased pain, and decreased temperature. A drug that does that might be called ibuprofen? Naproxen? How many of you have taken one of those two drugs? You've never taken one? Oh, okay. Whew. For a second, I thought you weren't human there. So, if you have a headache, you can take one of these drugs, helps make the pain go away. If you have a fever, you can take one of these drugs, makes the fever go away, or at least reduce. And if you have inflammation, it can help reduce the inflammation. Now, as adverse effects, it can also interfere with macrophage function, kidney perfusion, platelet function, gastric mucus, and uterine contractions. Now, as it turns out, this would be a therapeutic effect in what situation? No. If you wanted to induce labor, you would give give prostaglandin, not block it. In every woman's life, there comes a certain time of the month.
Cramps.
So, this is the reason why ibuprofen works for cramps and Tylenol doesn't. There's no Tylenol here, but there will be soon. Because Tylenol doesn't reduce COX-1 in the peripheral system. So, this is technically a therapeutic effect, but this is not. Now, why do we produce gastric mucus in the first place? Because our stomach produces what?
Acid.
So it can help digest foods. But the acid could destroy our stomach. So it's like chemical warfare against the food, but protect the stomach. What protects the stomach from the acid? Gastric mucus. And what tells your stomach to produce that mucus is the presence of prostaglandins. So, when we block COX, not only do we block these, but we also block this. And what does this put our patient at risk for?
Ulcers.
What kind of ulcers? Gastric ulcers. Yeah. Okay. So, and that can lead to sudden death if you're not paying attention. And this is the most dangerous of the adverse effects for most people. Some people can get renal problems, renal toxicity, where their kidney, they go into acute kidney failure. That's usually with overdose, not with therapeutic doses. And then you can also have increased bleeding risk from platelets. Now, there is one drug that we use in particular to inhibit platelet function. And what is that one drug? You can probably know this already. Just, if you have a heart attack, what drug do you take? Aspirin. So, aspirin is acetylsalicylic acid, so sometimes we abbreviate aspirin as ASA. So aspirin is the only drug out of the COX inhibitors that we use to target platelets. And every other drug, platelet inhibition is an adverse effect. For aspirin, it could be a therapeutic effect. Trying to prevent what? Sorry. Heart attack and stroke. But generally speaking, the decreased platelet function is an adverse effect. All right. So, yes, ma'am.
So, you're saying that if we block one of those things, it can block all of those things.
Right. So you give ibuprofen, and it blocks this, causing these therapeutic effects, but it also blocks this, causing these adverse effects.
So would an aspirin could lead to those adverse effects as well?
Yes.
Okay.
But with aspirin, we're targeting this one, as opposed to targeting these ones.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
That's not selective.
Yes. So there are four... There are four non-selective COX inhibitors that we need to know for now. There's like a dozen, but we're going to learn four. So the first one, we already learned it, aspirin. And it's special. We'll learn about why it's special later when we talk about blood clots. But for now, it's special, used for reducing platelet function. Then we have ibuprofen, which we already talked about. You need to know the normal doses for ibuprofen. So... Ibuprofen usually comes in 200 milligram tablets over the counter, and you can take them in units of, well, 200, 400, 600, 800, 1,000? What's the max? The max safe dose of ibuprofen? 800. So four of them at one time, and you can do that up to three times a day. Alternatively, so how many total would that be for a 24-hour period? Three times 8. 2,400. Now, what if you did 600 four times? 2,400. So, in total dose, those two are equivalent. So you can either choose every 8 hours, take 800, or you can do every 6 hours, take 600. Then you have naproxen. And naproxen typically comes in 200 milligram tablets. But the max dose is usually 500 or 550. And you can't exactly make that happen with the over-the-counter drug, the over-counter, the pills. One of the major advantages of naproxen is that it supposedly it lasts longer, so instead of taking it three to four times a day, you only have to take it twice a day. However, as a naproxen user, I can tell you that I often have to take it three times a day. Do I ever go over the max safe dose? Who, me? What? No. Never. Anyway, then we have one more we have to learn, which is ketorolac. Oh. Man, I forgot something about the opioids. Such a loser. Okay, so ketorolac. Ketorolac is also known as Toradol. And this one is very commonly used in urgent care centers and because it can be given IM or IV. And it's also used very commonly after surgeries because when you give it IV or IM, it has similar efficacy to moderate steroids. So it produces about the same amount of pain relief as a drug like codeine. So, what's the number one adverse effect you have to worry about for patients who are on COX inhibitors?
Gastric ulcers.
Now, what if we had a drug that was selective for just COX 2 and not COX 1? Would there be less ulcers? So we actually have COX-2 selective one, and that is called celecoxib. By the way, do you know what IB means? When you see IB in a drug, it means inhibitor. So it's a COX-IB, COX inhibitor. Oh my goodness. Now, there used to be other drugs in this category that you had to learn, like rofecoxib and valdecoxib, all inhibiting COX. But we no longer have to memorize those. Want to know why? Because they caused adverse effects in terms of cardiac function. They caused higher blood pressure and higher risk of heart attack. So they got taken off the market. Celebrex is the only one that has survived. Now, when you take COX inhibitors, any COX inhibitor, there is a risk your blood pressure could go up. And there is supposedly a small increased risk of cardiac events, which means like a heart attack or stroke. But these are still safe enough that they're on the market. The brand name for this is Celebrex. And Celebrex is a sulfa drug. So if you remember way, way back when we talked about antibiotics, sulfonamides, sometimes you'll have a patient who's like, oh, I'm allergic to sulfa, but they're taking Celebrex. So they're not actually allergic to sulfa in that case. They may have had an adverse reaction to a sulfonamide or some other sulfa drug, but it wasn't a true sulfa allergy. Any questions about COX inhibitors? All right, so now we have to go back in time for a moment and rewind to your opioid drugs, because you know what I forgot to do? Go over the actual drugs.
Oh, that's right.
Aha! So the first one that we have to do is morphine. Morphine was the very first one that was discovered. It's a natural drug. It's found in the opium poppy, along with codeine. By the way, we divide these into strong and moderate. So strong ones, morphine is the first one, and it has all of the effects we talked about earlier, plus has one other effect, which is it causes venous dilation. And that is going to cause a small decrease in blood pressure and a small decrease in the amount of blood going back to a patient's heart. And that actually makes it very helpful for treating some cardiac conditions like heart attacks. It can be given either PO or IV. It's considered the gold standard in that, no, we say gold standard, we don't mean the best, but we mean it's like the baseline you measure everything else against. Everything else is either stronger than, more potent than, or weaker than, less potent than morphine. Does that make sense? All right. Then we have one that I believe we've taken off the list, but I just need to mention it, meperidine. Demerol is a completely synthetic form of morphine. But it can cause, and it has fewer adverse effects in terms of nausea and biliary colic. However, it builds up into a toxic metabolite. When your liver clears it, metabolizes it, it turns into a poison. And that poison can actually damage your liver over time. So you can never have more than 2 days worth of Demerol. So nowadays, it's very rare to see Demerol given at all. So, then we have fentanyl. Now, fentanyl has a couple purposes. Inpatient, it's most often used in anesthesia for surgeries. You give them like a fentanyl gas and it puts them out cold. They're before your time, but there had actually been a terrorist event in Russia where these terrorists had taken over a school and were holding these kids hostage. So the Russians pumped fentanyl gas into the building, make them all go asleep, and they can go in, not have to hurt anyone, and they overdosed them, and everyone was dead. Now, most of the time, what you're going to see fentanyl given, you're going to see it given in the form of a patch called a Duragesic, and that's for chronic pain only. So you put the patch on, and it administers the fentanyl out over small periods of time for 3 days. Replace the patch with a new one. Next, we have something called hydromorphone. Now, hydromorphone is a synthetic form of morphine that's got a hydro on it. So it's morphine with a hydro is hydromorphone. And that is much more potent than regular morphine. And that is the brand name Dilaudid. So, like with morphine, you might be giving, like, say, 2 to 4 milligrams IV. With Dilaudid, you'd be giving, like, 0.1 milligrams. So, you'd be giving an enormously smaller dose with Dilaudid. Now, Dilaudid is also a very clean drug in terms of adverse effects. It doesn't have quite as many adverse effects as some of the other opioids, which makes it an addict's kind of drug of choice a lot of times. And the problem is, there, you know, over time, if you have a problem where you, you know, a medical problem where you have to go into the emergency room repeatedly with pain, you kind of learn which drugs work better and which ones don't. And so if over time you've learned that the Lauded works better for you, the next time you go to the ER, you go like, hey, don't give me the morphine, that doesn't really work, I need Dilaudid. And what does the nurse say? Drug seeking, you're an addict. Unless they have a good relationship with you, in which case they say, oh yeah, I remember the last time you were in blah blah, and I know you're not an addict, let's go ahead and give it to you. So it's one of these double-edged swords where when you know what works for you as a pain and pain management, you're afraid to tell them sometimes because you're afraid of being labeled as drug seeking or as an addict. Whereas if you don't, then they might give you a drug that has more severe adverse effects for you and doesn't work as well for you. It's a crazy mixed up world that we live in. So that's Dilaudid. And then we have methadone. Now methadone is a very, very long acting. It's like 36-hour half-life. As a result, it doesn't give a very high peak. So there's not a lot of high that's associated with it. So this is very commonly used in detox clinics when you want a patient to stop using opioids, but you don't want to give them withdrawal symptoms. Oh, speaking of withdrawal symptoms, what happens if you stop taking, if you've been taking opioids for a long period of time, what happens? Well, two things happen. One is you need a higher dose to get the same effect. What's that called?
Tolerance.
And the second is if you stop taking the drug, suddenly you get withdrawal symptoms. What would the withdrawal symptoms be, do you think? Say again? Not necessarily. It's the opposite of everything you had before. So if you had constipation, now you have. If you had urinary retention, now you. If you had meiosis, now you have mydriasis. And typically they're going to have, what do you call it? I'm trying to think of the word. Stippling of the skin. Chicken skin. What's it got?
Goosebumps,
yes. Can't think of it. Goosebumps, which is why we call it going cold turkey. Because when you go cold turkey, you get goosebumps on your skin. Anyway, so the treatment for the withdrawal syndrome is put them back on an opioid and then taper slowly. Now, withdrawal syndrome is not a sign of addiction. What's it a sign of? Chronic opioid use. So if you have a legitimate reason to be using it and you stop because now it's time to stop, what can you expect? Withdrawal symptoms. How do you minimize them?
By putting it back on the drug and tapering it.
Taper it. Okay. So that is the strong ones that we're going to learn about. Then we've got codeine, which is also natural and found in morphine. Now, codeine is an interesting drug because if you give it in high enough dose, it'll be just as strong as morphine. However, it will also damage your liver. So we only give it in smaller doses, which makes it moderate, not strong. How much drug? In this course, we're not really going to go over the doses that much, because that's something you can look up at the time that you give it. So there's a few drugs that we are going to definitely learn doses on, like we learned those because they're over the counter and you can use them yourself. But for the most part, that's something that you can look up at the time. We also mentioned normal doses with IV methylprednisolone. Yeah. But since you ask, a normal dose would be about 30 milligrams PL. Then we have oxycodone and hydrocodone. So these are both artificial versions of codeine that work better than codeine and are safer than codeine. But they got a bad rap. Why is it a bad rap? Because they became drugs of choice for addicts. Now, oxycodone started off first in terms of bad rap because of something called OxyContin. OxyContin is a continuous release form of oxycodone that is meant for chronic care patients. Sustained opioids are only for chronic pain. They are not for acute pain. But if you chewed it up, or if you crushed it up and
and dissolved it, now you got all of it at once. So oxycodone is usually found in the form of Percocet, which is going to be either 5 milligrams or 10 milligrams of oxycodone. OxyContin came in 20, 40, and 60 milligrams. So if you had 60 milligrams and you crushed it, it'd be like getting the equivalent of 6 oxycodones or 6 Percocets at the same time. Now, Percocet also has acetaminophen in it, which an overdose damages your liver. So you can't take too much Percocet. But by taking OxyContin, you can take a whole bunch of it really conveniently. As a result, it became the number one target of addicts throughout the country. And so that led to increased controls on it, so it was harder to get. And so then what do people switch to? If you make it harder to get one drug, what do? They switch to another drug. So they switched from trying to get OxyContin to getting hydrocodone. And at the time, oxycodone was Schedule 2, which required a physical prescription. Hydrocodone was Schedule 3, which you could call in. So, hi.
Hi. This is Dr. So-and-so. I'm trying to call in the hydrocodone for my patient.
So, one of the things they did was they changed hydrocodone from Schedule 3 to Schedule 2 to make it harder to get. Now, we need to know so there's some mixes, and we need to know those mix names. So we already said, when you mix oxycodone with acetaminophen, what do you get? Percocet. When we mix hydrocodone with acetaminophen, what you get is a brand name, either Lortab or Vicodin. Now, you do need to know those names. They will be on your test. The last drug that we're going to mention, and I just mention, is called propoxyphene. When you mix it with acetaminophen, you get something called Darvocet. Now, the thing about propoxyphene, it is a very weak opioid. It's so weak that it has very little analgesic effect. And what that made a lot of doctors think is, oh, that's the safe one. Let's give this to our elderly patients who are afraid of giving too much bad adverse effect to. But guess what? It's only moderate in the therapeutic effect of analgesia. It's not moderate in all those adverse effects we were talking about. So it is actually one of the worst drugs you can give an elderly patient because it doesn't work in terms of pain relief, but it works in terms of adverse effects. Eventually, it was on the do not prescribe to elderly list for like 15 years before, and doctors are still prescribing it for elderly folks. And eventually, the FDA said, hey, guys, can we just stop making the propoxyphene here in the United States? So it's no longer been available for at least the last 5 years. But how many of you want to go on mission trips? You can still get propoxyphene in other countries, sometimes over the counter. So you need to be familiar with what it is. And that is all of the opioid drugs. So one last thing I've got to mention with the OxyContin thing, because you could crush it and get super high levels. Now, it's meant for chronic pain patients, right? What do your chronic pain patients have that a normal person doesn't? How long have they been taking the drug? A long time. So they've built up tolerance. Now, let's say that grandma dies and little Johnny finds the OxyContin in the medicine cabinet. Oh, jackpot. So little Johnny takes a couple of the pills, crushes them up, drinks it. What do they get? Let's say they took 4 of the 40 milligram OxyContins. So they're getting 160. Now, how many are in an ordinary Percocet? 5 to 10. So let's say we're dealing with 10. So they're getting 16 times the normal dose. What's going to happen to little Johnny? Dead, respiratory arrest. So as a result of a number of fairly high in profile accidental deaths, and then all of the crime that was associated with it, well, eventually what they did, besides making it harder to get, was they also changed the OxyContin to what's called a micronized form. So the pill was consisting of a whole bunch of tiny little time released. So when you crush it up, It doesn't actually destroy the time-release mechanism. So for the last probably 8 years now, you haven't been able to get the old stuff that you could do that, you know, crushing trick with. So you crush it now, it's still time-released. So that makes it safer and harder to abuse. All right, on that note, I think we're out of time. We have still acetaminophen to go, and then we'll also talk about addiction and some general principles of pain management next time. All right, see you guys later.